What if I told you there's a simple three-word financial strategy that could transform your relationship with money forever? When Nick Majuli's grandfather died in 2019 with no assets, despite receiving $2,200 monthly in retirement income for years, it sparked a revelation that would eventually reach millions of readers. Just Keep Buying became not just the title of Majuli's best-selling book, but a financial philosophy embraced by everyone from college students to Wall Street veterans. As the chief operating officer at Ritholtz Wealth Management and creator of the popular blog Of Dollars and Data, Majuli's data-driven approach to personal finance has been featured in The Wall Street Journal, CNBC, and Bloomberg. Even celebrities like Ashton Kutcher have praised his ability to make complex financial concepts accessible. What makes this book different from typical financial advice? It challenges conventional wisdom with evidence rather than opinions, showing why you might need to save less than you think, why credit card debt isn't always bad, and why timing the market is a fool's errand. When I was 23, I had only $1,000 invested, but spent countless hours obsessing over investment decisions while thoughtlessly spending $100 on nights out, effectively wiping out a year's worth of potential investment returns in a single evening. Meanwhile, someone with $10 million invested would lose $1 million from just a 10% market decline, far more than they could likely save in a year. This contrast illustrates a fundamental principle. Saving is for the poor, and investing is for the rich. When you have little invested, focus on increasing savings. As your portfolio grows, investment decisions become increasingly important. To determine your focus, compare your expected annual savings with your expected investment growth. If you expect to save $12,000 next year, but your $10,000 portfolio might grow by $1,000, 10%, your savings impact is 12 times greater than investment returns. Focus on saving. If your expected investment growth exceeds potential savings, prioritize investment decisions. This balance shifts naturally over time. Someone saving $10,000 annually with 5% returns will see savings dominate wealth growth initially. But after 30 years, with $623,227 accumulated, annual investment returns, $31,161, will far exceed annual savings. By retirement, nearly 70% of total wealth comes from investment gains, not contributions. Where are you on this continuum? If you have no assets, focus on saving. If retired, focus on investments. For everyone else, your position should guide your financial priorities. Understanding this principle helps you direct your limited time and attention to where it will have the greatest impact on your financial future. Like the Dolly Varden charfish in Alaska that feast during salmon season and shrink their digestive tracts during lean periods, our saving strategy should adapt to changing financial circumstances. Traditional savings advice, save 20% of income or have 3x your income saved by 40, fails because it assumes stable incomes and equal saving ability across income levels. Research contradicts both assumptions. Family income volatility increased 25 to 50% from 1968-2005, and savings rates vary dramatically by income level. Federal Reserve data shows those in the bottom 20% save just 1% of income annually, while the top 20% save 24% and the top 1% 51%. UC Berkeley economists confirm this pattern exists across a century of American economic history. Determining how much you can save comes down to a simple equation. Savings equals income minus spending. Calculate these figures monthly, as most financial events occur monthly. While income is typically easy to determine, spending varies more. Instead of tracking every dollar, identify your fixed monthly expenses, rent, mortgage, subscriptions, car payments, and estimate variable spending, groceries, dining out, travel. Putting variable expenses on a single credit card, paid in full monthly, makes tracking easier. Despite widespread fears about running out of money in retirement, research shows the opposite problem. Retirees aren't spending enough. Texas Tech University researchers found that most retirees' financial assets hold steady or increase over time, as they typically spend only their income from Social Security, pensions, and investments without touching principal. Only about 1 in 7 retirees actually draw down their assets, with the average retiree leaving behind substantial wealth, $296,000 to $315,000, when they die. Contrary to popular belief, millennials are building wealth at similar rates to previous generations when adjusted for age and inflation. Even Social Security concerns are overstated. Projections suggest beneficiaries would still receive about 80% of benefits after the trust fund's depletion. The evidence suggests most people need to save less than they think. The biggest lie in personal finance is that you can get rich simply by cutting spending. Financial media perpetuates this myth by suggesting small cuts like eliminating daily coffee can make you a millionaire, while conveniently ignoring that such calculations require unrealistic 12% annual returns and decades of unwavering investment discipline. The truth is that most financial success stories involve either high income, extremely low spending, or both, not just mindset or discipline. Research from the London School of Economics demonstrates that lack of initial wealth, not motivation or talent, keeps people in poverty. Their study in Bangladesh showed that one-time wealth transfers enabling more productive occupations help people escape poverty. While increasing income is harder than cutting expenses initially, it offers a more sustainable path to building wealth. The key is unlocking your human capital, the value of your skills, knowledge, and time, and converting it into financial capital. There are 5 primary methods to achieve this. 1. Selling your time/expertise is straightforward with low startup costs, but doesn't scale since 1 hour of work equals 1 hour of income. 2. Selling a skill/service through platforms like Upwork can earn more than simply selling time because you can build a brand and charge premium prices, though it still doesn't scale easily. 3. Teaching online through platforms like YouTube or Teachable offers excellent scalability. You can create content once that generates income repeatedly, though standing out in competitive markets is challenging. 4. Selling products that solve problems offers tremendous scalability, especially with digital products. The downside is the significant upfront investment required to build and market the product. 5. Climbing the corporate ladder, despite being often dismissed in favor of entrepreneurship, remains the most common way people build wealth. Most millionaires follow conventional education and career trajectories, with many holding advanced degrees. The ultimate goal should be converting your human capital into financial capital by acquiring income-producing assets. Jerry Richardson, the richest NFL player in history, built his wealth not through football, but by owning Hardee's franchises and eventually the Carolina Panthers. Whether investing in your own business or someone else's, thinking like an owner is essential for building long-term wealth. Most financial advice creates guilt around spending through figures like Susie Orman and Gary Vaynerchuk, who shame people for small indulgences. To combat this, I propose 2 solutions, the 2X rule, and focusing on maximizing fulfillment rather than just happiness. The 2X rule requires matching any splurge purchase with an equal investment in income-producing assets. If you want to buy $400 shoes, you must also invest $400 in stocks or similar assets. This forces reevaluation of purchases while removing psychological guilt. The definition of a splurge varies by person and changes over time. For me, it was $100 at age 22, but closer to $400 now. The rule is flexible. The matching amount could go to charity instead of investments, allowing you to help others while enjoying guilt-free spending on yourself. Beyond the 2X rule, we should distinguish between happiness and fulfillment. Fulfilling experiences, like running a marathon, may not create moment-to-moment happiness, but provide deeper satisfaction. Research shows money increases happiness when spent on experiences, occasional treats, buying time, paying up front, and spending on others. However, these alone don't guarantee fulfillment. Drawing from Daniel Pink's motivation framework, spend money on things that enhance autonomy, mastery, and purpose. The key is determining what you truly value and aligning spending with those priorities rather than focusing on the purchase itself. Research from the University of Cambridge found that purchases aligned with psychological profiles led to higher life satisfaction than income alone. This challenges common advice like experiences over material goods, which may primarily benefit extroverts. While spending science offers guidelines, individuals must determine their own values and priorities to avoid living someone else's dream. Guilt-free spending comes from aligning purchases with personal fulfillment rather than external expectations. The Vanderbilt family's rapid financial decline after William H. Vanderbilt's death in 1885 offers a cautionary tale about lifestyle creep, increasing spending after income increases. Within 20 years of inheriting America's largest fortune, no Vanderbilt ranked among America's wealthiest due to extravagant spending. Dining on horseback, smoking cigarettes wrapped in $100 bills, and maintaining opulent Manhattan mansions. Unlike many financial experts who recommend avoiding lifestyle creep entirely, I suggest that some lifestyle creep can be satisfying. Most people can spend about 50% of their raises without significantly delaying retirement. Using a comparison between two investors, Annie, who saves 50% of her $100,000 income, and Bobby, who saves just 10%, I can demonstrate why high savers must save a higher percentage of raises to maintain their retirement timeline. When both receive $100,000 raises, Annie must save 74% of her raise to maintain her original 8-year retirement timeline, while Bobby only needs to save 14.8% to maintain his 49-year timeline. This counterintuitive finding occurs because Annie's spending would double from $50,000 to $100,000 if she maintained her 50% savings rate, requiring twice the retirement savings and delaying her retirement by 4 years. Your current savings rate is the most important factor in determining how much of future raises you should save to maintain your retirement timeline. Those with lower savings rates can afford more lifestyle creep. Someone saving 10% needs to save 36% of future raises, while someone saving 30% needs to save 59% of raises. Despite this complex analysis, I recommend saving 50% of all raises as a simple rule that works well for most people. For the majority of savers, with savings rates between 10-25%, this 50% guideline aligns with the optimal amount needed to maintain retirement timelines. This approach is easy to implement and remember. Half is for you, and half is for future you. Debt has been debated since biblical times, but determining whether it's always bad isn't straightforward. While high credit card interest rates should generally be avoided, credit cards can reduce risk for low-income borrowers through what researchers call the credit card debt puzzle. This occurs when people hold credit card debt despite having savings to pay it off. Research shows these borrower savers have different perceptions about future credit access and willingly pay interest to reduce long-term risk of insufficient funds. Debt can be useful in two primary scenarios: to reduce risk or to generate returns exceeding borrowing costs. For risk reduction, debt provides additional liquidity during emergencies, smooths cash flow, or decreases uncertainty. For example, not paying off a mortgage early maintains cash reserves, while taking out a mortgage locks in housing costs for decades. Debt can also fund investments with returns higher than borrowing costs, like education, small businesses, or home purchases. Despite rising college costs, the lifetime earnings premium for graduates remains substantial. More rigorous research, controlling for demographic factors, shows the present value of this premium is about $260,000 for men and $180,000 for women. However, earnings vary dramatically by major. The lifetime difference between the lowest paying major, early childhood education, and highest paying, petroleum engineering, reaches $3.4 million. A simple formula to evaluate degree value is value equals increased lifetime earnings over 2 minus lost earnings. Using this calculation, most undergraduate and graduate programs remain worthwhile investments even when financed through debt. For example, the typical $80,000 cost, including debt, of a public university education requires just a $10,000 annual earnings boost to break even. Debt affects more than finances. It impacts mental and physical health, though effects vary by debt type. Research shows households with high credit card debt report significantly lower psychological well-being, while mortgage debt shows no such association. Physically, high financial debt relative to assets correlates with higher stress, depression, worse self-reported health, and higher blood pressure, even after controlling for socioeconomic factors. Those who benefit most from debt are those who can strategically choose when to take it, using it to reduce risk or increase return. Unfortunately, many households don't have this luxury, with 28% of individuals facing unexpected expenses averaging $3,518 in 2019, lower-income households often need debt to cover emergencies. Home ownership involves substantial one-time and ongoing costs beyond the mortgage. One-time costs include down payments, 3.5 to 20% of purchase price, closing costs, 2 to 5%, and real estate agent commissions, typically 6% total. Together, these transaction costs can range from 5.5 to 31% of the home's value, making frequent buying and selling financially unwise. Ongoing costs include property taxes, maintenance, 1 to 2% of home value annually, homeowners insurance, and possibly private mortgage insurance. Additionally, home maintenance requires significant time investment. Many homeowners describe it as having a part-time job. The primary cost of renting is long-term risk. While renters can lock in housing costs for 12 to 24 months, they have no control over what they'll pay a decade later, always buying at fluctuating market prices. Renters also face housing instability. Beloved apartments might become unaffordable due to rent increases, forcing frequent moves. Despite popular belief, housing historically hasn't been a stellar investment. Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller calculated that U.S. housing returned just 0.6% annually, inflation-adjusted, from 1915 to 2015, with most gains coming after 2000. For about 100 years prior, inflation-adjusted housing values remained essentially flat. My grandparents' $28,000 California home, purchased in 1972, was worth $230,000 by 2001. But had they invested their $2,800 mortgage payment in the S&P 500 instead, they would have accumulated over $950,000. Despite California having some of the best real estate returns in the U.S., stocks outperformed their home by roughly 4-to-1. Though homes may not be stellar investments, there are compelling societal reasons to own one. In 2019, the U.S. homeownership rate was 65%, rising to nearly 80% for households with above median income and over 90% for millionaire households. More importantly, home ownership determines what neighborhoods people live in, where children attend school, and access to certain communities. I recommend buying a home when three conditions are met. 1. You plan to stay in that location for at least 10 years to offset transaction costs. 2. You have a stable personal and professional life. And 3. You can afford it. 20% down payment and debt-to-income ratio below 43%. While you don't have to put down 20%, you should be able to, demonstrating financial responsibility. Investing wasn't always necessary. Before the late 19th century, most people worked until death with no concept of retirement. But when Chancellor Otto von Bismarck created Germany's first government retirement program in 1889 and lifespans began dramatically increasing, investing became essential. There are three primary reasons to invest: saving for your future self, preserving wealth against inflation, and replacing your diminishing human capital with financial capital. Research shows that people who visualize their older selves save more effectively, and those who cite retirement as a savings motive consistently save more than those with other goals. Inflation acts as an invisible tax on currency holders, slowly eroding purchasing power. At just 2% annual inflation, a currency's value halves in 35 years. At 5%, it halves every 14 years. While $1 would need to grow to $15 to match inflation from 1926-2020, that same dollar invested in Treasury bonds would have grown to $200 and in U.S. stocks to $10,937. Human capital, your skills, knowledge, and time, is a diminishing asset. While skills can improve, time only decreases. Investing transforms this waning human capital into lasting financial capital. For someone expecting to earn $50,000 annually for 40 years, the total future earnings of $2 million has a present value of approximately $1.2 million at a 3% discount rate. This means your ability to work is theoretically worth $1.2 million today. As you age, your human capital's present value decreases each year, while your financial capital should increase to offset it. By investing, you're essentially rebuilding yourself as a financial asset that can provide income after employment ends. The key to building wealth is continually buying diverse income-producing assets. While most investors focus on stocks and bonds, they represent just the beginning of potential investment options. Stocks offer high historic returns, 8 to 10% annually, and are easy to own but come with high volatility. Bonds provide lower returns, 2 to 4%, but with greater stability and are excellent for portfolio rebalancing. Investment properties can deliver magnified returns through leverage, 12 to 15%, but require significant management effort. REITs offer real estate exposure without management responsibilities, 10 to 12% returns, while farmland provides inflation protection with lower correlation to financial markets, 7 to 9% returns. Small business investments can yield outsized returns, 20 to 25%, but success requires deep community involvement and substantial time commitment. Royalties generate steady income uncorrelated with financial markets, 5 to 20% returns, while creating your own products offers greater control than most other asset classes. Most stock markets go up most of the time, suggesting investors should deploy capital as soon as possible rather than waiting for better entry points. Despite the chaotic course of human history with world wars, depressions, pandemics, and political crises, markets have consistently trended upward over time. Warren Buffett noted that despite the 20th century's numerous catastrophes, the Dow rose from 66 to 11,497. Historical data shows that if you randomly picked a trading day for the Dow between 1930-2020, there's a 95% chance the market would close lower on some future trading day. The median wait for a lower price is just 2 trading days, though the average is 31 trading days. This creates the illusion that waiting for better prices is wise. However, sometimes lower prices never materialize or require extraordinary patience. When deciding between investing all your money at once, buy now, versus spreading it out, average in, the data overwhelmingly favors buy now. For the S&P 500 from 1997-2020, average in underperformed buy now by 4% in each rolling 12-month period and lost out in 76% of all periods. This pattern holds true across virtually all asset classes and time periods. Even at elevated market valuations, buy now generally outperforms average in. When analyzing performance across different CAPE ratio percentiles since 1960, average in consistently underperforms buy now, though the gap narrows as valuations increase. Trying to time market dips is equally futile, even with perfect timing. Using data from 1996-2019, a hypothetical buy-the-dip strategy that invested only at market bottoms between all-time highs generally underperformed regular dollar-cost averaging. Over 40-year periods, buy-the-dip underperforms DCA more than 70% of the time, even with perfect timing of market bottoms. When simulating buy-the-dip missing market bottoms by just 2 months, it underperformed DCA 97% of the time. The core message is simple and powerful. You should invest as soon and as often as you can. This approach has proven successful across different time periods and markets, with U.S. stocks beating cash 98% of the time over 10-year periods since 1926. Those who benefit most from financial markets are those who can withstand their inherent volatility. Analysis reveals that the optimal drawdown threshold for investors is 15%. Avoiding years when markets decline by 15% or more would have outperformed buy and hold by over 10x from 1950 to 2020. However, there is no magic genie to predict these declines. Instead, investors must accept volatility as the price of admission for equity returns, using diversification as their primary defense. As Charlie Munger advised, if you're not willing to react with equanimity to a market price decline of 50%, two or three times a century, you're not fit to be a common shareholder. Market crashes present exceptional investment opportunities. Using data from the 1929 crash, $100 invested near the 1932 bottom grew to $440 by 1936, roughly triple the return of investments made in 1930. This outsized opportunity comes from the mathematical reality that percentage losses require even larger percentage gains to recover. A 33% loss requires a 50% gain to break even, and a 50% loss requires a 100% gain. When U.S. stocks were down 30% or more, 1920-2020, less than 10% of recovery periods yielded annual returns below 5%, while over half produced returns exceeding 10%. For markets down 50% or more, future annualized returns typically exceeded 25%. Despite the just keep buying philosophy, investors will eventually need to sell. The author identifies only three legitimate reasons to sell investments: to rebalance, to exit concentrated or losing positions, or to meet financial needs. Unlike buying, which should be done quickly, selling should generally be done slowly or as late as possible, since markets tend to rise over time. Without rebalancing, portfolios naturally drift toward their highest returning assets. While rebalancing typically lowers overall performance, it serves to control risk. Analysis shows that never rebalanced portfolios typically experience larger maximum drawdowns, 30%, compared to annually rebalanced ones, 25%. The most important reason to sell investments is to actually enjoy the results, funding retirement or making significant purchases. This is particularly relevant for those with concentrated positions who have won the game but continue playing. Fund the life you need before you risk it for the life you want. No matter how wealthy you become, you may never feel rich because we constantly compare ourselves to those who have more. Our perception of wealth is relative. I share the story of my friend John, who didn't feel rich despite his privileged upbringing, because his friend Mark received $100,000 for his birthday, while John only got $1,000. The wealth perception problem extends to the ultra-wealthy and most people in the upper income spectrum. Research shows households above the 50th percentile consistently underestimate their relative position. Even those at the 90th percentile believe they're only in the 60th, 80th percentile range. This misperception stems from the friendship paradox. Just as people with many friends appear on more friendship lists, making others feel less popular, wealthy people are overrepresented in our social networks. Everyone, except the world's richest person, can point to someone wealthier and say, "I'm not rich, they are rich." Most Americans with median net worth, $93,170, are in the global top 10%, yet don't consider themselves rich. The same relativity bias that makes billionaire Blankfein claim he's merely well-to-do. Being rich is entirely relative, varying dramatically by age, education, and reference group. Time is your most valuable asset, the one thing money cannot buy more of. While wealth offers freedom and opportunity, time ultimately determines what's possible in your life. In 1960, after his wife was injured walking a treacherous 30-mile path around a mountain ridge in Galar, India, Dashrath Manji vowed to carve a path through the mountain. Using only a hammer and chisel, he worked alone for 22 years, eventually moving 270,000 cubic feet of rock to create a 360-foot-long passage that reduced travel distance between villages from 34 miles to 9 miles. As we age, our lives often fail to meet our high expectations, creating a happiness U-curve that bottoms around age 50 before increasing again. Research shows young adults in their 20s consistently overestimate their future life satisfaction by about 10%, with this excessive optimism diminishing over time as people become more realistic. Like growth stocks with high expectations that often fail to deliver, we start our lives with great hopes. As we age, we lower our expectations, sometimes too much, becoming like value stocks that can deliver pleasant upside surprises when things go better than anticipated. The just keep buying rules represent the optimal strategy for maximizing financial success regardless of when or where you start. We're already playing this time traveler's game in real life, making financial decisions without knowing what the future holds.